Osiris.
Hey, this is Brendan from Umphreys McGee. This podcast is part of the Osiris podcast family. Osiris is a growing community of music and culture podcasts, connecting music fans with conversation, commentary, and of course, lots of music. Osiris works in partnership with Relix Magazine.
We are here with Dolph Ramsor, who you may know is the sponsor of our podcast, the original sponsor of our podcast, the godfather of North Carolina music.
Dolph being a sponsor of our show literally helps us keep the lights on, keeps batteries in the Zoom recorder, keeps the microphone cables working. Dolph, we appreciate all your support over the past year.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be a part of it.
We've been running an ad for the Ruin Brothers, which is one of the new albums that came out that you guys put out, but was produced by Rick Rubin, correct?
Correct. Correct.
I texted Dolph after the second time we ran it and told him that I've never seen a more effective advertisement because it had worked on my entire family. Because after I heard that ad on my own podcast a couple times when I was editing it, my wife listens to the Ruin Brothers all the time now, and I've listened to that album several times. It worked on us, man.
Well, that's great to know. That's great. And they're such talented guys, and they're sweet fellas as well. They're from the north of England, Scunthorpe, which is a very working class area, but they're really good guys.
So yeah, so we're grateful we had you as sponsors. And as I said the first time we had you on the introduction, maybe over a year ago, and I said that I've known Dolph over a decade, and he's only ever sponsored really good things and put his name behind really good things. And I didn't know if this was going to be the one that broke him, and I didn't want to be a part of it. But a year later, we're still going, and we're thankful for it.
Well, again, glad to be a part of it, and y'all keep rocking. I'll keep rocking and having some fun doing it.
Big team, little me.
Yes.
That's right. So check out the Ruin Brothers album and all the other albums and the bands on Ramsor Records. You can go to ramsorrecords.com, and you can, if you're interested in any of the albums there, you can enter the promo code HISTORY and get 10% off. So go do it. Show Dolph some love, and we're thankful for him.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now, and right now I'm sitting in Boston Airport. It is Sunday, December 9th, the night before this airs, afternoon actually, and flying back after 4 days at the Association for Slavic, East European, and Eurasian Studies Conference, where I had an absolute blast, got to present some new work that I'm working on the history of Tsarist-era debt after the Soviet repudiation. Which I know means a lot to everyone, but it's a cool story. Maybe I'll tell you guys about it sometime. Anyway, just wanted to say hello and let you know this week's episode is with Peter Kornbluh. He's at the National Security Archive. He's published multiple works on information agencies, the CIA. He spent a lot of time trying to get this information released to the public, and it's fascinating because he ended up getting the government to release documents on Cuba and our involvement there and Chile. The coup in 1973 that the United States helped with in various different ways we'll talk about here. We recorded this episode on Tuesday, the previous Tuesday. So we were talking about some things that were happening that day. So that's just to explain, you know, if we're talking about something and you're like, that wasn't today. Yeah, that's fine. Sorry about that. I'm heading back from the conference. And as you can see by the fact that I'm recording this intro right now, I brought my gear with me. Carried it around, brought it from Nashville to Boston, carried it all over the conference, and was unable to find anybody who wanted to sit down and talk to me. Which is funny because as a host, sometimes I forget that I'm also one of the people on the panels. And when you spend all day, literally all day from 8 a.m. until 6 on panels and talking about history, sometimes you just want to relax with a beer at the end of the day. I did, however, get some cool episodes lined up that we'll be hopefully recording in the next couple of months. Some cool ones. Allison Smith from University of Toronto in particular is teaching a class or taught a class on the history of the Arctic. And I heard about that and trying to line her up to be on the podcast. Anyway, I'm excited. And shout out to all the good scholars who were here at the conference and friends who said they listened to The Road to Now, which makes me happy. Because it's really nice to know that we reach an audience of folks who are academics and non-academics. And as you've heard us say before, that's one of our goals, was to engage a broad variety of people in different professions and different backgrounds. And it makes me happy when I see that that's working. So thanks to them and everyone who listens. We really appreciate it. So now, please enjoy our interview with Peter Kornbluh. Hello, Road to Now listener. It seems that by being here, it means that you like to get information by listening to it. You might be listening right now in your car, while you're driving, maybe you're mowing your grass, maybe you're just sitting in a room by yourself, staring at a wall. In any case, you're learning by listening. I like to do the same thing, which is why a couple weeks ago, I went looking for a new audiobook company, and I came across Libro.fm. Libro.fm is an audiobook company which allows you to purchase your audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers, recommendations for bookstores around the country, and also a playlist curated by The Road to Now featuring our past guests. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobook at the same price as the other audiobook companies, whatever they are, but you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. All you need is a smartphone and the free Libro.fm app. If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to, check out recommendations from our podcast featuring guests including Jefferson Cowie, Douglas Brinkley. There's so many of them. You can go check it out. I made the playlist myself, and I'm really proud to do this. The best part about Libro.fm is that you literally are sponsoring your local bookstore. And if you're anything like me, you really like your local bookstore, but sometimes you want audiobooks. Well, here is the solution to the problem. Road to Now listeners can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of 1 month. That means for just $15, you can sign up and you'll get 3 months with one free book. And if you're anything like me, you're going to download a giant biography of like Grant or something and listen to it over the course of a month. It's all the same price. $15 a month. How do you get that? All you have to do is go to Libro.fm. That's Libro. Letter F, letter M, and enter the promo code RTN at the top of the page. And they also have gifts. You can buy a gift for somebody if you're looking for that special holiday gift. Give them the gift of knowledge. Just go to Libro.fm, enter the promo code RTN, and we thank you for listening.
Peter Kornbluh, welcome to The Road to Now.
It's a great pleasure to be on the show.
Well, just to start out, Peter, could you tell us about the National Security Archive and the work that you do?
The National Security Archive is a really interesting place. Some people know it as the other NSA. Of course, the real NSA, the National Security Agency, is one of the most furtive, top secret agencies in the U.S. government, if not the most furtive and top secret. But the National Security Archive, the other NSA, is quite the opposite. It is dedicated to transparency and accountability in government. Our whole mission is to find out what the government has done in our name, but without our knowledge, and share that information with the broader public to have a really informed debate about what U.S. foreign policy has been and should be. And, we've been doing this for over 30 years now. We've gotten some really interesting documents out. And we've generated a lot of debate over a lot of issues. The archive really kind of has three functions. It's actually an archive. We build documents collections, we digitalize them, we share them with universities around the world through a company called ProQuest. We are also the leading advocate in the United States of America for freedom of information. We're almost evangelical in our push to bring this concept of accountability and transparency and access to information, the fundamental right to know, not only in the United States, but to other countries. We work on laws both here and abroad to foster Freedom of Information Act activities. And finally, we are like the CSIs of history. We are forensic historians. We don't dig up the bodies or find out where the bodies are buried, but we dig up the documents. We excavate the documents that may shed light on where the bodies are buried and who put them there. We use Freedom of Information Act documents a lot to pursue human rights cases and accountability and bring human rights violators like Augusto Pinochet and other dictatorial figures to justice. Alberto Fujimori in Peru was convicted with the use of some of our documents in his trial for human rights atrocities. And we've done that around the world.
So you just mentioned Chile, and this is something you've been very active in recent years. You've been a part of the Chile Documentation Project, and you've been very active and very successful in securing information related to the United States support of Augusto Pinochet, by all accounts, a brutal dictator who was eventually taken in on on human rights abuses. Could you tell us that story? Kind of give us the background of what happened in Chile in 73, how the United States was involved, and then what you all were able to do to finally help bring this guy to justice.
Well, in September of 1970, the leader of the Chilean Socialist Party, Salvador Allende, was elected president of Chile. He was the first socialist to be democratically elected in Latin America. And this threw Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger into a big tizzy in the United States. One of the things that Kissinger feared most was that a socialist would be democratically elected in a country like Chile, would succeed in redistributing wealth and bringing, you know, justice and economic equality to a society much in need of it, and that other countries in Latin America and even more so in Europe would follow this model of socialist parties joining with communist parties. It was known as Eurocommunism in those days, and actually electing leaders. And his argument to Nixon was, geez, you know, we won't have anything to say about this because all these people will be democratically elected. How are we going to protest that? So we have to make sure that Allende fails. And, you know, Nixon and Kissinger sicked the CIA on Allende to destabilize his ability to lead Chile, to destabilize the Chilean economy. And after 3 years, Chile was very destabilized, and Allende was overthrown by a Pinochet-led military coup.
The phrase was to make the economy scream, right?
Well, that was part of Nixon's order to the CIA director, Richard Helms, on September 15th, 1970. And we have the handwritten notes that Helms took of that meeting. And they literally are the one document in the whole history of U.S. intervention in Latin America and around the world that we have the presidential orders to overthrow an elected government leader. In this case, it was a preemptive strike because Allende had been elected, but he hadn't been even inaugurated at the point that Nixon gave this order. And the effort that the CIA made initially was to actually promote a coup that would stop his inauguration in early November of 1970. That operation, which was known as Operation FU Belt, led to the assassination of the Chilean commander-in-chief, General René Schneider, just a bald assassination that the CIA paid for and helped organize, and then helped the people who committed that atrocity flee the country so they wouldn't talk. It was really an incredible operation, very bald. It failed to promote the coup in the end. Instead, Allende was the country rallied to Allende, and he was inaugurated. And then they went to kind of Plan B to just to stabilize the economy and make it Chile ungovernable.
So first of all, let's talk about the forensic historian side of this. How did you get your hands on those handwritten notes?
Those handwritten notes were actually obtained by Senator Frank Church for a committee known as the Church Committee. That he led in the mid-1970s. And this was the first effort by the U.S. Senate to investigate CIA covert operations. And again, what the CIA was doing in our name without our knowledge. And so Church got a handful of documents declassified for his investigation, including that one. But what my organization, the National Security Archive, was able to do was push for the declassification of thousands of other CIA and FBI and Pentagon State Department documents later when General Augusto Pinochet was arrested in London in 1996. And that led to the declassification of 24,000 top secret documents that nobody had ever seen before. So the rough stories of U.S. intervention in Chile to overthrow Allende were known, but truth be told, Kissinger and Nixon had completely lied about this to Congress and to the American public, and the documents exposed those lies, including the extent to which the U.S. government was involved in the assassination of General René Schneider.
Gentlemen, as we sit here and speak, right now a select group of senators are meeting with the CIA director, Gina Haspel, to discuss the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, supposedly at the direction of Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. Is there any difference in the U.S. behavior of, say, the Trump administration has received a lot of criticism for saying, hey, it's a tough world. Things happen. But we need to have a relationship with Saudi Arabia. Is there any moral equivalence here between what Nixon and Kissinger were doing?
Kissinger said exactly the same thing. Let me tell you. After Pinochet took power with the support of the United States, and we were able to obtain all the secret communications between Pinochet and the U.S. government in the days following the coup. But after he took power, Kissinger's aides came to him. At that point, Kissinger was both national security advisor to the president and secretary of state. And his aides came to him and said, you know, Newsweek magazine is reporting that thousands of Chileans have been killed in the aftermath of the coup and that there are bodies floating in the river and blood on the streets. And, you know, and Congress wants to know what our role was. And Kissinger said, I want you to pass this message to Congress. You know, however bad this government, this new government may be, it's better for our interests than the previous one. And so Kissinger immediately ordered the State Department to make the argument to Congress and the American people that these human rights atrocities were of no great consequence to the United States, and we had larger interests, which included economic interests, and of course, this interest in making sure that socialism didn't get a foothold in Latin America through a democratic process.
And so the brutality of that day, September 11th, 1973, I remember I had a friend who was from Chile, and he said, we had a 9-11 before you had a 9-11. Because the Chilean 9-11 was 1973 when this coup actually went down. I had a professor, one of my mentors, Jeffrey Bortz, who's a professor at Appalachian State University, who was there. He was dragged out of his apartment, beaten, and nearly killed before they finally realized he was an American citizen and let him go. And he talked about everyone being dragged out to the soccer stadium in the middle of town. And just they were like buses full of people they were dragging down there. Could you talk about that for a minute? Like the imagery of the day in September of 1973, when that coup takes place?
Well, there was a lot of violence in the streets. That day is depicted in the movie Missing, which is a movie about the death of an American student journalist named Charles Horman and a colleague of his, Frank Teruggi, both of whom were assassinated, at least Teruggi in Teruggi's case, and probably Horman's as well, in that stadium that you just mentioned, that soccer stadium. And more than 13,000 people were taken first to a smaller Chile stadium and then to the National Stadium, which has been renamed Victor Jara Stadium. The famous folk singer from Chile was also murdered, executed in the smaller soccer stadium just 4 days after the coup. There's going to be a Netflix documentary coming out in January on this very issue. And your listeners, if they watch it, will be able to see the footage of what Chile was like in those days following the coup and the brutality that followed. And just like the Trump administration in its realpolitik approach to Saudi Arabia wants to turn the other cheek when it's clear that there is a truly brutal, vicious, brazen dictatorship there, sending assassins around the world to kill journalists like Khashoggi, we turned our cheek, you know, and of course supported. We did not only ignored Pinochet's atrocities, we actually supported his consolidation of power and helped him build a secret police force, which then sent terrorists around the world to do brazen acts, just like the Khashoggi assassination in Turkey. Pinochet and his secret police sent a team to Washington, D.C. to blow up a former Chilean foreign minister and ambassador, Orlando Letelier, and also killed at the same time with a car bomb his 25-year-old colleague at the Institute for Policy Studies in 1976. And we eventually got the secret CIA documents on Pinochet's role in authorizing, instructing, and leading the cover-up of that atrocity. And there really is a comparison to be made between the CIA documents of that atrocity, the Letelier assassination, and the CIA report that Gina Haspel, you know, may well be sharing with the intelligence committees right today as we are speaking. And it's imperative that that intelligence report be declassified so the world and the American public knows what the evidence is about the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia.
Have you begun to work on that?
I the National Security Archive certainly has, and a lot of other places, including a lot of journalistic newspapers and entities in Washington, have as well. These are the types of documents, though, that take a long time. It took over 40 years to get the CIA summary of Pinochet's role as the intellectual author and leader of the cover-up of the Letelier assassination. Over 40 years to get that document. And it came about through some special circumstances. We finally did get it. But, you know, this is one of those, this document that the CIA has now on the Khashoggi assassination is kind of the holy grail of documents on Saudi Arabia at the moment. And there'll be a long effort made to get that material declassified.
So I might be stepping out of the box here. I apologize if I am. And it just made me think of the missing 28 pages from the 9/11 report dealing with Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. So a lot of people went after those pages, and they were released, but heavily redacted, very heavily redacted. You know, they don't show any big conspiracy on the part of the Saudi Arabian government. You know, the full history of that episode has yet to be told, but we know a lot more about what happened there than just about any other episode in the history of the United States. If you read the final report and look at the footnotes, which, by the way, the National Security Archive, my organization, has tried to FOIA, do a Freedom of Information Act request for every single footnoted document in that report on our 9/11. I mean, we've taken the same position vis-a-vis our own 9/11 as we tried to do on Chile's 9/11. You know, all the documents have to be released. We have to know how this happened and in order to make sure it doesn't happen again. And that has been our philosophy for all the major secrets that can affect the future of the United States. So, but that is an amazing report that the Joint Commission did on 9/11. And there's we know a lot about what really happened.
Just one last question on Chile. One of the things that's fascinating is not just the support for the coup, but the overall American involvement in the Pinochet regime. You know, to most of us who look at a government that comes in, overthrows the democratically elected government, installs a dictator, I think as Americans, our gut reaction is to say, that's not okay. But there were a lot of people, and particularly economists, who saw the regime of Pinochet as an opportunity to implement new free market ideals that they had always wanted to implement. Could you talk a bit about how they, these economists, Milton Friedman and others, went down and saw Chile as a kind of a garden to throw their seeds in?
Well, sure. You know, economists like Milton Friedman and others, you know, not only saw a laboratory for their pure free market arguments, although how they could feel like a dictatorship that had no free labor unions, no freedom of the press, no, you know, a closed Congress, you know, how that really showcased the free trade and the type of economics that the Friedman economics that they pursued in Chile really wasn't the laboratory that counted. But, you know, there was a gravy train there. They were all hired as consultants by various Chilean the Chilean government and by Chilean businesses. And Chile went through an economic crisis in the early 80s. That turned a lot of people against Pinochet. Eventually, the left was able to organize, and Pinochet was so desperate to have his own kind of rule legitimized that he had written an election into a constitution that he had written, a plebiscite. And people went in 1988, he thought he could control this plebiscite, but in fact, the Chilean people voted against him. And the U.S. government actually got wind of a plot, according to the declassified documents, that he had for a second coup on October 5th, 1988. He was going to kill a lot of people in the streets, blame the left, annul this plebiscite where he had lost. And the U.S. government blew the whistle on this. The Chilean people completely opposed it, and the rest of the military junta refused to sign on to the second coup, and Pinochet was forced to step down. And, of course, eventually this led to his arrest in London and all the efforts to bring him to justice. It's a great story. It's told in the documents. It's, you know, worth thinking about now because we have a situation where the United States once again is ignoring human rights as a policy, cozying up to dictators like Duterte in the Philippines and the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia, and Putin in Russia. And so, you know.
Don't forget North Korea.
Korea, yes.
He likes him.
Trump's bro in North Korea. But, you know, and so the debate over human rights and support for democracy is once again front and center in the United States. And let me just say, you know, the coup in Chile and the Pinochet dictatorship and the CIA role and Nixon and Kissinger's role did foster a pretty big debate in the United States in the mid-1970s. And to some degree, we actually won that debate for a number of years. Then came Reagan and the covert war in Nicaragua, and then came 9/11, and all the kind of moral gains in U.S. foreign policy were completely washed away in the name of fighting terrorism. And that's still the argument that's being made today about why the United States should have a realpolitik approach to a country like Saudi Arabia, along with all the billions of dollars that they pour into our economy, of course. And Chile resonates, and the declassified documents continue to resonate. But at least we have that history to write about and talk about and have discussions like we're having right now on your podcast.
Peter, I can't help it. I need to ask you this. This is burning in my a hole in my brain. What do you think of WikiLeaks? Julian Assange, I mean, you've spent your life declassifying classified documents, showing the world, exposing to the world what governments don't want their citizens to see. WikiLeaks, good guys or bad guys?
So it's very complicated with WikiLeaks. And of course, it's gotten even more complicated now that Assange played such a significant role in what I believe was a clear collaboration with the Russians to undermine the 2016 election in the United States. And I should just point out that the National Security Archives' goal in the world is to create and support laws that allow citizens to request and obtain access to documents that they have a right to, that their taxpayer dollar paid for, so that they know what their governments are doing and can discuss in an informed manner what they're doing and what they should be doing. How can we have a democratic discussion if we're not informed, if we're kept in the dark?
But is it, Peter, is it a matter of timing is everything sometimes, and maybe certain documents, they're better left unseen for a time?
There's some documents which you need to keep secret because they protect people in place. Documents which, of course, would reveal that we have spies in Russia or spies in Saudi Arabia or particular types of listening devices placed in specific places. Sure, you know, we need to protect operational people. But a lot of the documents are kept secret just because they reveal criminal activity, frankly, and immoral activity. Or they are what former Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger once said to me was CYA. You know, they're kept secret to cover your ass. And that's, you know, a cover up is not a legitimate reason for keeping documents secret. So less secrecy for particularly our country and most countries is a lot better than secrecy, because, you know, criminality and dictatorship and atrocities happen when there is no accountability. That's just exactly the way it is. So we believe in more. But my point was is that WikiLeaks, we had a certain approach to this, which was to push for laws that allow people to get access to documents. We do not deal in leaked documents. And WikiLeaks is all about the leakage of documents. Yes, it's important to have whistleblowers, and we have been among a team of organizations that pushed Obama and presidents before him to understand the legitimacy of certain whistleblowers who were blowing the whistle on misconduct. But in WikiLeaks' case, they dumped a lot of documents that had the names of people, the names of people who were talking to the U.S. government, who then those people, those thousands of people were, their lives were in jeopardy. And WikiLeaks did initially start to hear those protests, and they started to give their documents to places like the New York Times and the Guardian, a whole selection of newspapers, for them to post. And of course, they would go through and they would take out the names or black out the names of people before they posted. And then WikiLeaks would then post what these other reviewers had already posted. But Julian Assange stopped doing that. And of course, now he's changed his MO completely. and is in pretty big trouble at this point.
Isn't it funny that Edward Snowden, you know, he stole all these documents, right, for WikiLeaks, correct?
Yes. And no, he didn't steal them for WikiLeaks.
Okay. Okay. Is there any connection between Snowden and Assange? I'm going to show my ignorance here.
So that there wasn't when Snowden appropriated and downloaded those documents.
Okay.
People he gave them to didn't work with WikiLeaks. What happened was is that when Snowden, it was clear that the U.S. government had found him and was going to go after him in Hong Kong. WikiLeaks did play a role, and Julian Assange's supporters and lieutenants played a role in getting Assange to Russia.
Okay, so wait, hold on, pause.
Connection right there. But
why go to Russia if you are stealing these documents from the United States government to declassify them in the name of freedom? You run to Russia. It makes no sense.
Well, first of all, you should be detailed about this. He didn't run to Russia. He went to Hong Kong. And it was there in Hong Kong that he gave the documents to the other journalists, including Glenn Greenwald, who did not work for WikiLeaks.
Right.
And Laura Poitras. And so, but once it was clear that his location was revealed, he needed to leave. Russia was not to be his final destination. He was going to go to Russia, fly through Cuba to Ecuador, and be given safe haven there. But the Cubans, who were at that point in deep secret, top secret talks with the Obama administration to normalize relations and get their spies back from the United States, declined to let Edward Snowden fly through Cuba to Ecuador. And so Snowden basically, and then his passport had been taken away or canceled, and he really just couldn't fly around the world. So he was stuck in transit in Russia, and then eventually the Russians gave him asylum. So that was not his choice to go there. It certainly wasn't his final destination, but it is probably the one place that he's, you know, going to be stay out of prison.
Wow.
Well, Ben, you've spent a lot of time in Russia.
I have, and I stayed out of prison the whole time I was there.
Barely.
I did get accused of being a spy a lot.
Getting back to the National Security Archive, you know, we've taken this approach to making sure that we have the secrets of state in our hands for the sake of history and for the sake of the future. And we've followed that mission in countries, and we've tried to use history to make history. And we've done that most effectively in issue of U.S.-Cuban relations. And I know that you've been interested in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And, you know, we went after all the documents in the Cuban Missile Crisis because, geez Louise, can you think of any single episode in contemporary history where we need to know how we got into that situation and we need to know how we got out of it? And if we don't have every single piece of paper that was generated by the Cuban Missile Crisis declassified and in the hands of historians and analysts, how are we going to know and how this happened and how we got out of it and how are we going to inform ourselves to make sure that a similar crisis doesn't happen in the future?
That's one of those cases, I think, where you look at the documents and the story totally changes. It is not something that necessarily looks particularly good for the Kennedy administration once you realize that he may have been able to, if he were a bit savvier, prevented that whole thing from happening.
Well, certainly if Kennedy had taken advice of a number of people in the public not to follow up the Bay of Pigs, which he inherited from the Eisenhower administration, by setting up a whole new set of covert operations against Cuba called Operation Mongoose and appointing his own brother to run that operation. Robert Kennedy kind of ipso facto became a quasi-CIA covert operations director, even as he was officially Attorney General of the United States. It was kind of bizarre. And so if he hadn't engaged in operation, if Kennedy hadn't moved on to Operation Mongoose, the Cubans might not have felt so completely threatened that they decided to accept the Soviets' offer of having nuclear missiles as a deterrent for yet another likely U.S. invasion. And we did something interesting. I organized a 40th anniversary conference on the Bay of Pigs in Cuba where I brought some of the surviving CIA people and some of the surviving members of the exile brigade that they sent into Cuba, and everybody met with Fidel Castro and his commanders and sat around a conference table and discussed a history of antagonism and aggression in a civil way. And then from that conference, we moved on and did a 40th anniversary conference on the Cuban Missile Crisis, where we brought Robert McNamara and Arthur Schlesinger and Richard Goodwin, who recently passed away, and a number of other CIA officials. And the Soviet generals came who were still living, who had been there before, and Fidel was there.
That's crazy.
His commanders. And the whole point of this was to discuss this history, get the Cubans to release their documents, bring new U.S. documents. Our idea was we would use history to make history, and we would call attention to the Cuban Missile Crisis. This was just as George W. Bush was invading Iraq in the aftermath of 9/11. And as Arthur Schlesinger put it during the conference, you know, if George Bush was my student, I would have given him an F because he's failed my history class. Bush invoked the Cuban Missile Crisis. He claimed that the Cuban Missile Crisis set a precedent for him doing this when it did the opposite. Kennedy decided not to invade Cuba. He decided to do everything possible to make sure that aggression didn't spiral out of control. And that's the model of the missile crisis, not that we should actually use aggression like George W. Bush did in Iraq.
Was your conference the conference? I know that there's a moment in Fog of War, the McNamara documentary, where McNamara says he finally sat down to speak to Castro and he asked him, did you have access to launch the weapons? And if you did or didn't, would you have used them? And Castro looks at him and says, no, we didn't have access. But if I had, I would have launched those weapons at the United States.
Yeah. Well, McNamara went to the 30th anniversary conference in 1992 in Cuba that we helped with. And then he came to the 40th anniversary conference, which I organized with the Cuban government, and spoke out against nuclear weapons. Everybody used the occasion of the conference to say, you know, it's obvious that there's no room for mistakes when the world has nuclear weapons, and yet mistakes have been made that have almost led to the firing of these weapons. And one can only conclude, McNamara argued at the end of the conference, is that we should get rid of nuclear weapons because somebody's going to make a mistake and they're somehow going to get used in error. And, you know, this is the type of way that historical documents are used to promote a discussion that needs to be had. We need to learn from the past. Otherwise, of course, we're not only destined to repeat it, but we are repeating it already. And that's the problem for U.S. foreign policy. And that's the problem for secrecy. We really need more transparency because transparency leads to more accountability and more democratic representation in our governments and our policies.
Well, right now, it's a big news day, right? So this is a big news week. And the 41st president, George H.W. Bush, is currently lying in state in the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C. Was he involved? Was he not involved in the Iran-Contra scandal? You've played a pivotal role in making available important documents and information about that Reagan presidential scandal. It was one of your earlier projects. Could you give us a brief overview of the scandal and the role the National Security Archive played in making that information public?
The National Security Archive basically cut its teeth when it was first founded in the mid-1980s on the Iran-Contra scandal. In 1985, when a journalist named Scott Armstrong founded the National Security Archive, there were these covert operations going on to support the Contra war in Nicaragua. And there were these illegal arms sales going on to Iran at the time. And the archive had just opened its doors when the scandal broke, and we were in a very good position. I had already been doing historical work on the Contra War, and Scott himself had been to Iran and had obtained all those shredded documents that were shredded after the Iranian Revolution, and the
Wow.
When the militants took over the U.S. embassy, the U.S. officials had shredded all the documents in the embassy.
So let me ask you this question, and I know we're really taking a lot of your time, and I appreciate you for being so gracious, and this is a lot of fun for us. A lot of people say with Whitaker now as the acting attorney general, he has the power to withhold any report that Robert Mueller hands in to him. Is it possible that the American people would never see the Mueller report?
So, you know, one of the great top secret documents of all time is going to be the report of the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller. And there's going to be a fight over getting that report out. Obviously, the Attorney General of the United States, who's been appointed by President Trump, I would say rather explicitly to put a lid on this whole situation, the Russian connection, is going to try and keep that report from getting to Congress. Trump himself will start tweeting about it. But there's going to be a real fight that will go on for weeks, months, and perhaps years, and perhaps even decades to get that report released. There won't be very many copies of it. It'll be a historical battle. And where our country is, you know, in terms of secrecy versus openness, cover-ups versus transparency, and truth versus lies, is going to be determined by the fate of this report. And so the whole issue that the National Security Archive stands for, access to documents that the American public deserves to know about, will really come to play over the discussion of the future and accessibility of that report. Don't we deserve to know what happened in the 2016 election?
Yes.
Isn't that kind of fundamental before the next presidential election takes place? And that's the question that all Americans are going to have to ask themselves. And of course, my organization, the National Security Archive, has a resounding yes. We do deserve to know answer to that very question. So, you know, there are all these documents involved. We are in as you and I talk, you know, former President George H.W. Bush is lying in state here in Washington. I don't want to rain on the parade of the hagiography that's in the mainstream press about him, but there are a lot of things that he did that are much darker than the decency and honorable man that he's being depicted as right now. Iran-Contra and the Iran-Contra scandal is one of those things. When you could easily compare George H.W. Bush to Donald Trump, we have been discussing how Donald Trump may use pardons to sabotage the Mueller investigation and keep key witnesses from testifying. But it was actually George H.W. Bush that did that in the Iran-Contra scandal. He went ahead and pardoned all the key players in the scandal who'd been convicted of their role, of their criminal role, including the former Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, former Assistant Secretary of State for Latin America, Elliot Abrams, one of the leading CIA officials, Dwayne Claridge, all of them pardoned, part so that Bush himself wouldn't have to testify to various things that he had participated in during the Iran-Contra operations. And he himself covered up his role to help himself get elected president of the United States. He wrote a false memoir about his role in the Iran-Contra affair. He misrepresented to Dan Rather in a famous 60 Minutes interview about his role in the affair. And when we finally got the documents, including, by the way, his own diary, which he withheld illegally from the special prosecutor, Lawrence Walsh, when we finally got those documents, we could see exactly what his role was. And one of the documents that is on the website of the National Security Archive is the legal summary by the special prosecutor of George H.W. Bush's role in the Iran operations and the Contra operations. And even though he was never indicted or prosecuted for perjury, for cover-up, for illegal activities, you'll see in that document how easily he could have been if Lawrence Walsh had wanted to in the end.
Mr. Vice President,
yes.
The President himself has said he wants all the facts out. He gave up such things as even his own diary. Every principal, including Secretary Shultz, he gave up some of it.
Well, Dan, let's be careful here because you're
saying. Yes, sir, I want you to be careful, Mr. Vice President, because
I will be careful. But I want to
the problem here is that you repeatedly said in the meetings You sat in a meeting in which Secretary Schultz, in the most forceful way, registered his objections. And then you said you never heard anybody register objections.
If it was the most forceful way, I've heard George Shultz be very, very forceful. And if I were there and he was very, very forceful at that meeting, I would have remembered that. I don't remember that.
Then how do you explain that you can't remember it and the other people at the meeting say he was apoplectic?
I wasn't there at that point.
You weren't in the meeting?
I'm not suggesting. I'm just saying I don't remember it.
I don't want to be argumentative, Mr. Vice President.
You do, Dan. No, this is not a great night because I want to talk about why I want to be president, why those 41% of the people are supporting me.
And Mr. Vice President, these questions are
judge a whole career. It's not fair to judge my whole career by a rehash on Iran. How would you like it if I judge your career by those 7 minutes when you walked off the set in New York? Well, now, would you like that?
Well, Mr.
I have
Vice
respect
President,
for you, but I don't have respect for what you're doing here tonight.
Mr. Vice President, I think you'll agree that your qualifications for president and what kind of leadership you'd bring to the country, what kind of government you'd have, what kind
exactly.
of people you have around him is much more important than what you just referred to. I'd be happy
well,
to
Well, I want to be
that.
Judged on the whole record.
Well,
and you're not
And I'm trying
me
to set the record straight.
You invited me to come here to talk about, I thought, the whole record.
I want you to talk about the record. You sat in a meeting with George Shultz.
Yes.
He got apoplectic when he found out that
he
and the president were being part of sending
Reagan.
Missiles to the Ayatollah of Iran. Can you explain how you were supposed to be the, you're an anti-terrorist expert. Iran was officially a terrorist state. You went around telling.
I explained that, Dan. I wanted those
Mr. President, the question is,
out of there.
But you made us hypocrites in the face of the
killed.
World. How could you sign on to such a policy?
Well,
and the question is, what does that tell us about your record?
Signed on to it. The same reason the president signed on to it. When a CIA agent is being tortured to death, maybe you err on the side of a human life. But everybody's admitted mistakes. I've admitted mistakes. And you want to dwell on them. And I want to talk about the values we believe in and the experience and the integrity that goes with all of this. And what's I going to do about education? And there's nothing new here. I thought this was a news program.
Well, I had hoped, Mr. Vice President, you would tell us to whom you expressed your reservations.
Yes, I did.
When you expressed them
Point
and what the reservations
testified
were.
Under oath.
What were
He's
the reservations?
Reservation about getting the control of an operation in the hands of a foreign power. Don Regan stated the other day, and I never heard a word of it on CBS, that the vice president, in the presence of the president, spoke up about his concern about the whole cover of an operation being blown and secret and people that you're dealing with putting their lives in jeopardy.
And you weren't
and
concerned about sending missiles to the Ayatollah Khomeini?
Every covert action.
You
but I, the president has explained that. The committee looked at that. And so there's nothing new on this.
Mr. Vice President, I appreciate you joining us tonight. I appreciate the straightforward way in which you engaged in this exchange. There are clearly some unanswered questions remain. Are you willing to go to a news conference before the Iowa caucuses, answer questions from all
conferences since March?
I gather that the answer is no. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Vice President.
Let me just say that was as mendacious an interview as any presidential candidate has ever given.
I watched it about 6 months ago. It is incredible. It's incredible.
And it's all false, you know. And so basically, in terms of the Iran-Contra operations, as a candidate, Bush lied himself into the presidency. His role in Iran-Contra came back to haunt him when he ran for re-election against Bill Clinton and Ross Perot. And right before the election, the special prosecutor presented an indictment of Caspar Weinberger, where he discussed the fact that George Bush had this diary and had withheld it. And he also discussed, I believe, in the indictment that Weinberger had recounted being in a meeting with then Vice President Bush and sharing with him all the discussion of how illegal the Iran operations were. And everybody knew they were illegal. And so this came out right before the election in 1992, I guess. And Bush lost, not by a big amount, but he lost. And he blamed the special counsel and Iran-Contra coming back to kind of bite him in the ass for his loss of the presidency in 1992.
I think that he didn't know how a supermarket checkout line worked is part of that. He was out of touch.
I think he also checked his watch.
He checked his watch during the debate.
And I also think there was another special prosecutor named Ross Perot. Oh, taking 19% of the popular vote. What's up? Anyway, this is amazing. Before we go, one thing we always like to ask people, because it's the road to now, you know, how did we get here? How did you, Peter Kornbluh, a young man growing up in Ann Arbor, Michigan,
decide that you were going to dedicate your life to making the government talk?
You know, it goes back to the origins of my involvement in with the issue of Chile. And on September 12th, 1973, I was in Pioneer High School in Ann Arbor, Michigan. This was the morning after Pinochet's coup in Chile. And there happened to be a Chilean girl in my class that morning who was incredibly distraught. And she had a discussion with our teacher that morning about what had happened in her country and how the blood was flowing in the streets and how she couldn't reach her relatives. And, you know, that conversation left a big impact on me. I did eventually befriend that young woman and eventually came to Washington with her. I married her. I had a baby with her. I got divorced from her. She certainly had a great impact on my life. And I started working on the Chile issue when I was in college. And in fact, it's a really cute story. I was in my honors thesis at college. I was trying to explain why the United States gave a damn about Allende's election. I just couldn't understand it. Was it because of the economic interests of big corporations like AT&T and Kennecott Copper? Was it because we really believed in democracy? No. Was it because of the national security argument that was true? How could that be? So I really wanted to find out. And while I was writing my honors thesis, an article appeared in the illustrious magazine called Penthouse, written by the former U.S. ambassador to Chile, Edward Corey. And in those days, before whitepages.com, there was no way to find somebody, but I wanted to interview him for my honors thesis in college so I could finish it. And of course, I called.
You literally read the magazine for the articles.
Right. I paid no attention to the adjacent pictures. And I read the article in the magazine. And then, of course, I wanted to interview the author, the retired ambassador to Chile, Edward Corey, who basically said that Nixon and Kissinger had made him the scapegoat and that they were responsible for all this. And I literally called Penthouse Magazine, and a woman named Bambi returned my call. And she said, well, I can't give you Edward Corey's telephone number, but he's willing to talk to you, and here's his address. And turned out that he lived 2 hours down the road from where I was going to college.
What?
So I borrowed a car, and I drove down to Stonington, Connecticut, and interviewed him over the course of 16 hours. And he had taken the secret cables that he had sent from Chile in 1970 and 71, and he'd retyped them. He couldn't take the copies of them, but he'd retyped them onto white pages of paper, and he read them into my tape recorder. And of course, I ended up writing an honors thesis that had all these secret documents.
What?
In it. And of course I got highest honors. And that started me on the road to working on getting secrets of state declassified. And I had this wonderful opportunity that, you know, more than 20 years later, I worked to get those very documents, the original copies of them, declassified after Pinochet was arrested. And I actually held them in my hands after President Clinton did order a special declassification of 24,000 Chile documents in 1999 and 2000. And it was quite gratifying. And now some of those documents are actually hanging in the Museum of Memory and Human Rights in Santiago, Chile. We did a special exhibit there, and Chilean students from another generation are able to see them, and people who visit from around the world are able to see them, and that's, you know, that's what these documents are for. Declassified documents from the past almost always have some kind of immediate resonance in the present, and all the documents that we've got declassified at the National Security Archive certainly have that, play that role.
Can I just say that that's the most amazing how I got here story I've ever probably ever heard?
It has quickly moved to the top of the list.
Also, can I say this? This is amazing. It just hit me. I have this brilliant student that I worked with, and she just graduated. Her name is Brooke Fitzwater. She's been studying basically biology in the oceans there for, you know, the last 2-3 years, ever since she was young. And she emailed me the other day, and she was asking questions, and I've got to get back to her. She's asking questions about Chilean's perception of Americans, and she said she went to the museum that you helped set up. And it really blew her mind. And so there we are, full circle.
So in your honors thesis, did you have to footnote Bambi?
I tell that story to students as an inspiration for their research. I say to them, can you imagine a world without, you know, Google, and where you can't just Google a name and find out where somebody is, you know, where you actually had to pick up the phone and track somebody down and
shoe leather. Yeah.
So, but well, yeah, Peter, that was a great experience. And that started me on the road to the work I've been doing for over 30 years now at the National Security Archive.
Peter, this has been a wonderful afternoon. Thank you for taking the time and being so kind and gracious to speak with us today.
It's been a great pleasure to be on your show. Your show's got a great name. It's an appropriate title. We've got to always know the road to now so that we know where the road is going for the future.
Thank you.
That's right. We look forward to speaking to you again in the future. We want to thank our Patreon members for their continued support, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Peggy Donica, Jeff LeCane, and Fig White. To join our team of patrons and get extra content, you can go to patreon.com/theroadtonow, or just go to theroadtonow.com, our website, and click on the support tab at the top of our page. If you're unable to support us financially, that's okay. We've all been there before. You can still support us, though, by telling a friend about our podcast and by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. That only takes a few minutes, and it does a lot to help us spread the word. The Road to Now is produced by Bob Crawford and Ben Sawyer. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer. And today's music, like almost always, is by the talented and lovely Paul DeFiglia. For the Road to Now crew, I'm Ben Sawyer. Take care.
Osiris.